Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, man. Also, we're liars because we're recording this before we do Weird Things. So it's not after. Everything you know is a lie.
And Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, everybody.
Gentlemen.
I love the fact that I'm like, it's all a conspiracy. Everything's a lie. And Justin's like, I'm going with it.
We're all moving. Keep moving.
Knew this all along. So we actually have several questions for After Things that I almost ignored because it was in our Weird Things folder, but that would tell me to pay more attention. So starting right off the top, let's jump into this. This is from Ken. Hey, After Things. I guess we're the things in After Things now.
Oh, right? I love it. The three things. We're the After
Things. Maybe Weird
Things.
We're the, yeah. I never thought about this. We're the Weird Things.
I like that.
Right now, the After Things is, I love single mic podcasts, including both of Justin's, and want to get good at making them. I have a podcast that's been talked about before on After Things, Today's Tea with Kenny P. The problem is, it's a heavily produced beast with sketch comedy and AI conversations. It's difficult to explain, and it just takes too long to get into those Gladwellian 10,000 hours. I'm lucky to get two episodes out a month, and I'm unwilling to slack on the production with it. So I want to start a second horse Pucky, live to hard drive podcast. It'll be weekly minimum, but I plan to push myself to do multiple a week. My question is, Justin, what kind of pre and post production do you do for your single mic podcast? How similar different is the process between jury and politics time, politics, politics? Any tips on how to streamline the process between hitting record and producing something that isn't complete garbage? Andrew, I noticed you've been doing something similar with those live streams. What insights can you offer? Brian, I'm just going to mention your name to make you feel good.
Yeah.
No,
Brian,
do you think an extended DC Lego verse could have any of the same success as Marvel movie verse? What property should get the Lego treatment next? Any insight into doing those other jokers had to say regarding single mic podcast? Bryce, what's the real dirt on these guys? Do you have any favorite single mic podcasts? Don't you dare say Justin. I make a crack about it, and I didn't read it, and then I really just went for the same
and he realized he's definitely making the same crack. Okay, well, first of all, let's talk about the most important thing first. I have issues with the Lego Batman movie. We can talk about this.
We'll talk about later. There was a magician who killed himself at the Magic Castle. And Brian and I have this heartfelt conversation about this. And he's like, and now about the Lego Batman movie. Yeah. With the same amount of emotion. The same amount of anguish.
There's a lot to unpack in both of those experiences.
Speaking of tragedies, let's get into this Lego Batman.
All right. I think Justin is the star of this letter. So take it away, Justin. Talk about what it's, what's your production process?
Yeah. All right. So here's the deal. If you are doing a one mic show, understand that you are going to become very, very, very familiar very, very, very quickly with the idea of how hard it is to maintain interest in rhythm and tone and everything. The biggest thing that I learned in doing both jury and politics is that you got to keep doing them. And really the biggest thing that you're going to learn first is getting through that fear of I'm talking too much. Because in any conversation, at a certain point, you wind up having to take stock if you are a good human being, you take stock and say, well, am I talking too much? Like, should I initiate conversation with somebody else? And that is going to be a point that you are going to feel when you're doing a one mic show. Production wise, the biggest thing that I believe in general is that I only edit things if I absolutely have to, because I know it's not my favorite part of the process. I know it will hinder me. It will hinder me doing it at all. So that means you got to be better about pre-production. It means you got to be better about editing stuff or having stuff ready to go. It means that, if you screw up something in the first 5 minutes that really makes you crazy, that you should just go ahead and start over again. there's, you know, you just kind of got to reverse engineer. It sounds like you are a little bit more into the idea of post-production, and if that's your jam, then that's cool. But I would always recommend to people to limit, even if you're good at it, even if you like it, limit the amount of stuff you need to do. Try to solve as much as possible on the front end.
I certainly think that when you're dealing with the challenge of how do you improve, you know, as you talked, as he points out, that trying to get the reps in. I remember the 10,000 hours thing is, it's sort of a neat Gladwellian thing. It's also not really a true thing.
Well, I mean, yes and no. It's definitely not technically true, but it is true insofar as the core premise of if you want to get good, you got to put time into a thing. And, you know, you got to draw a line somewhere, and if that line's going to be at 10,000 hours, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and I would make the statement like that. One, it's a Gladwellian thing that it takes an obvious thing. It says yes, you do have to do it a lot. But then when we set this number of 10,000 hours, which is true of some things and not true of other things, it becomes this thing that now it's stuck in his mind of, do I need 10,000 hours? And I would say that it can be true of some things may take more, but some things can take less if you have a process to improve. 10,000 hours. Again, is this wonderful thing that he was able to latch on to because it made it this marketable, promotable thing, like, hey, 10,000 hours. And there are far more exceptions, I would say, to that. But that doesn't mean – but it means that you have to be – intensity. Intensity is one of these things that you have to say, how do I get better? You know, your 1,000 hours could be as good as most people's 10,000 hours if you have a process to improve and try to say, how do I get better at what I'm doing? In the case of, you know – writing, podcasting, things like that, the more feedback cycles you have, the more attention you're paying to it, and the more you're looking and self-correcting, the more opportunities you have for self-correction, the faster you'll get better in certain things. So I would say that if part of the holdup for the, you know, getting to the point of getting a lot of reps in is this one thing takes a lot of work, maybe you do this and then you just find other opportunities to speak extemporaneously or whatever and do that, so you're not just waiting. Like, my problem I had was as a magician was that I was a stage magician.
Yeah.
And the opportunities to perform on stage were very, very limited because there are only so many stages. So I picked up close-up magic so I could get in front of people more often. So I could go do close-up magic in any party I was at. I could do it in school. And so I was doing this close-up magic to get better at my stage magic. Now, I never got to put in 10,000 hours on stage, but I got to put in thousands of hours doing close-up magic. So that would be my suggestion, is what are other things you can do more frequently that will help that?
That's really interesting, because the idea of an affiliated 10,000 hours, there's certain experience that gets you close to achieving the competence that comes to 10,000 hours, but only peripherally so. Mm-hmm. For example, let's say you want to run a nightclub. Well, then certainly the 6,000 hours you spent DJing at a nightclub, you know, in some way contributes to that that total number. Yeah, sorry,
Working with people in like food service, like being a waiter, it's actually can be great because you learn, I got to go up to that table and however rude these people were, I've got to reset and be perfect and be this cheery person. Not unlike when you're recording a scene or you're doing things like that. So yeah, there are a lot of ways you can say like, okay, what can I do in these other tasks that are going to help me towards the greater task? And you find a lot of those skills translate over to it. And when we're talking like very literal things like learning to play the a violin or things like that, or a piano and stuff, that particular type of repetitious skill, like, yeah, I don't know of a faster way to do that. I don't know that we've found better ways to do that. But things that are multiple factors that go into it, you can certainly find ways, I think, to accelerate that. So I would say for my live streams, I do a very minimal amount of planning. I pick a topic or a starting point on that to get people into the conversation, then let it go forward. But they're not planned shows. And the reason I do the live streams on Periscope is because if I was trying to plan them, I would take forever. And if I was trying to edit them, I would never release them. So I chose a medium where I just do, hey, that's a good question. I throw that out there and then I pop the stream open and then try to keep the conversation going. You'll notice the first 10 minutes of my Periscope sessions, I'm just having a conversation with myself, because I assume that one, most people watching are going to be watching the recorded version of it. And two, I'm waiting for people to come on board. And so I can't just say, hey, any questions up front, and then let it sort of stall out. So what I do.
I don't know that this is actually good advice. It might be incredibly bad advice, but I can say that we've talked about this on After Things, that I'm a firm believer that you need to be bad before you be good and so on. That's why I adore my experience of street performing on 6th Street in Austin. But I know that in the early days of live streaming, I would have what I called the BB Live Show hangover, where I'd wake up and it was not so much about how much I drank the night before, but it was very much about, oh my God, what truth, what uncomfortable truth did I reveal last night? And my my first reaction was always, well, there's clearly only one thing to do, and that's to cover it up with an even more outrageous truth or whatever. So in that regards, I would say just produce a lot of, because at some point the signal will come through that noise.
The other big thing is that you have to realize that there's so much in the world, and it really depends on what you want to do with it. Like, to be honest, the Jury podcast, I literally just did that so I could get good at it because I really admired One Mic Radio shows.
It was the hardest thing you could think to take on, and so you took it on.
Well, I mean, if it's as it became clearer that doing podcasts was either going to be a hobby that people enjoyed me doing or Dare to Dream a moneymaker, that meant I wanted to get better at it. And I had no training aside from doing, you know, comedy on stage. I had no training in doing radio. And I thought, well, what's the most impressive radio show that I'd ever heard? Like, what's the one where you listen to and it's like, wow. Like, there are people that are on radio shows that are funny. There are people that are on radio shows that are really insightful. There are radio shows like NPR that does fantastic editing and sound design and stuff like that. But the one that I always found the most impressive were One Mic ones. And so it was like, hey, let me just have an opportunity to do that. If you want it to be a success, then you really have to think about what is successful before you go into doing it. Because I would not want to mix that chocolate and peanut butter. Don't learn how to do a One Mic show expecting to be the most successful One Mic show. Like, get good at doing the One Mic show and then think of how you can steer that vessel into success town.
Yeah.
Have that plan for what your expectations, your goals are. Figure out the way to get to it. And, you know, it is, and I've said this before, Justin and I started podcasting roughly the same time, maybe Brian too. And I see the difference in those guys and how many, you know, these guys multiple times a week. I watch the difference when they do their shows versus I do my stuff. And I could say, well, I've spent as many years in them, but I'm not getting anywhere near as many reps as they have. And that's just a big part of it. And I think also one of the things, it's frustrating. You'll talk to somebody who's like, I've been doing this for 10 years. But it's like, yeah, but has it been good? And like, weight trainers can be the worst. Is you'll meet people who are like, will train other athletes or train other people who have horrible information that took them forever to get to where they got to, because eventually they were going to make some gains and they don't realize they have bad information. But the more times at bat, the more self-correcting you are, the better your path is going to be.
Yeah.
And enjoy it.
Hey, so since we're doing this out of order, do we want to do another question or
we got two more questions. They're good, and then I think we can do great if we want. Does that sound good?
Yeah, that works.
Okay. So this is from Jason. Says, hello everyone. Excuse me, we are things. Usually people write in and ask how to be a better writer. However, my question is a little different. I would like your thoughts on how to learn to write when you were never really taught how in school. Long story short, my school district did not put a heavy emphasis on writing to the point where I graduated high school without learning what a preposition was. God knows how many sentences I've ended with one. I didn't think much of it at the time, but now it's starting to bother me. I even find things like writing an email like this to be very difficult because I get very hung up on whether I'm using commas correctly or if my sentences are structured correctly. At this point, I've probably read through this email about 15 times, and who knows how many more I will before I send it. Do any of you know of any good resources that someone can use to basically learn to write from scratch? I'm 35 now, so I pretty much feel like that's where I'm starting from. I find the three of you give fantastic advice, so I'd love your thoughts on this. Thanks for the show and all you do.
Can I give some very counterintuitive advice? And I believe this is profound enough. Like, I never would have written The Professional's Guide to Fire Eating if it weren't for this advice. And it's dumb, and it sounds dumb. My advice is turn off the monitor. Literally turn off the monitor. Look at a blank black screen. And because what is happening to you is you are suffering paralysis because you are trying to edit as you write. Those are two different phases. You need to write first and then edit after. And if you turn off the monitor, you can just say everything you do and then go back and approach it with the time delay and say, I'm seeing this for the first time. This is poorly put. You should really restate this as X, Y, and Z and so on.
No, I certainly think that's helpful when you're going through that paralysis. I wonder if Jason's question is more deeper to the point of not knowing, even when he's looking at it, where does the comma go? How do I structure this? And Jason, I'm going to tell you, you're not alone. I coasted through high school, you know, because I could be creative enough and I could get away with stuff. But if you asked me about, you know, structure, grammar, all that, I knew I had an intuitive idea, but I did not know. I'd never paid attention to what were prepositions and these sort of things, dangling participles. I learned that later. I became a better writer or understanding that later. And that came from working actually with James Randi. As Randi would read my letters, would read my correspondence that I was, you know, doing for the foundation, and he'd make corrections and stuff. And I learned about, you know, I learned my comma usage and my semicolon usage from him. And so I had somebody who taught me how to be a better writer from that and to pay more attention to that. Then I read books like The Art of Readable Writing by Rudolf Flesch, which is a really good book. It's an old book, but a very, very good book that gets into understanding that. The classics, you know, it was like Strunk and White. Okay. You know, the Eats, Shoots, and Leaves about basic grammar. I would say those three books can be super, super helpful, and they will clearly explain, especially Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. It's a bit of a grammar Nazi, and she expresses that as such.
Speaking of which, I really the audio, I did the audiobook version of Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, and it was very clear that, I felt like I'd read or listened to the wrong thing. I don't know.
I thought it was helpful to understand where they were, you know, people like that are coming from. So I at least knew what the point, what I understood what the discussion was.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is, like, I thought upon listening to it, I was like, there's something else I should have read that is a better version of this, because it sounded like it was like just an hour long audio program basically. So
I can't imagine reading that or in that audio format though, a book that's about, because if I couldn't
exactly.
Yeah. So I would say, like, those are some of my suggestions for books, and then take a class, go take a night school class. And I knew that I had deficits in writing as a writer that I needed feedback. I took night school classes at my local community college, and I was in there with a bunch of 20-year-olds, a lot of very hot 20-year-old girls in that class. It was made. It was incredible. It was literally that first day of class. Me and the other dudes are sitting there watching each girl step into class. We're like, it was stacked. Anyhow. My point is
No, but back to the 20-year-old girls. Let's just
Meanwhile they go and look down and they're all holding Bud Lights and it's like, what?
Yeah. It was an amazing experience. But that was a great class because it wasn't so much about grammar, but that was part of it. And just having being in that cycle, having feedback and whatever, do that. Don't feel bad, Jason. More people feel the way you do than you may realize. This is a very normal thing and also comes into usage. I don't know how much, you know, like, again, I had a school that taught this stuff. I didn't care. I just wanted to tell stories and I had to learn the rest of it later on. And I'm still learning, but I see there is a clear evolution in my writing over the last 5 years where I feel that. My editors may not feel the same way. But the point is, you're not alone. I would suggest reading those books, taking some night school classes. It can be fixed. You can learn this. Your letter to me was very well constructed. When you spend your time doing this, you're able to put it together. You're able to clearly articulate it. And trust me, you have much better grammar than most of the stuff we get.
110%. The big things that I would say is grammar slammers. If you are very, very concerned about just drilling yourself on grammar or learning stuff like that, there are these little quizzes that are like grammar slammers that'll just give you sentences and you got to figure out where it is. If part of what you want, if the point of what you're doing is just so you are not personally embarrassed by sending somebody something that has incorrect grammar or punctuation, then I would say stuff like that. If you want to write more, then I would say find a reason to write every day in a place where you are publicly posting it. At the bare minimum, Twitter, and then further than that, you can find other resources that you can write and post things. And I have always found that that is one of the only things that can really cut through all of my fog of like, I can just do this, I can just do that. It's like, if it's publicly posted, then it's something that I would take more seriously. Although then again, my Twitter is just riddled with misspellings.
It's understanding two different mediums need more attention than others. I get people who write to me and then they'll apologize. Oh, my last email, I meant to say this. I feel bad because you're a writer. I'm like, do you read like my Twitter postings and stuff I do, or even some of my books? And
that's
like,
one of the Twitter is a remarkable evolution as far as language, insofar as that it is causing everybody to respect brevity in a way that we haven't seen since, the Victorian internet of Morse code and so on. I will write stuff that I would never ever write in email, certainly wouldn't write in a book or whatever, but it feels right because it fits the 140 character limit of what's in Twitter.
Yep. So we have one more question.
Go ahead.
From Bob. Over the past few years, I've gotten a lot of opportunities to host screenings, interviews, and live Q&As. It usually goes great, but I recently had two incidents of heckling that I found myself totally unprepared for. The first was an audience member who raised his hand when I was taking questions in the crowd and proceeded to tell the filmmakers on stage how bad he thought all their films were. I cut him off, saying everyone's entitled to their opinion, and moved on, ignoring his raised hand for the rest of the event. The second time was a few weeks later when the filmmaker on stage during the Q&A after his documentary on race relations in the South started making politically and racially charged statements to get the crowd wound up, even going so far and taking shots at conservative audience members. It was difficult to cut him off since he wouldn't pause or give back the microphone, but I finally cut in and said our time was up and the theater needed to close. Since Andy, Brian, and Justin all have experience with live stage shows, how do you usually deal with antagonistic behavior both on and off the stage?
Man, oh man. There are times you have a lot of power, and there are times that it's important to just let somebody, because what this person really wants is to be heard. And you can acknowledge this person in a way that shuts them up. What is it you really want? What you really want is to get the show back on the rails that you've laid out there. What are your tools? You can shut them down. You can meet force with force. You can fight it. And another tool is understanding, basically what they're hoping to achieve, and figure out if there's a way you can grant it that doesn't hijack your show. There have been shows where I have been in a position to just speak words like eject this person, and then they were ejected and it was not a problem, right? Those are very, very rare. Most of the time it's like what you're saying, in which case it's like, okay, how do I give this person enough of what they want so that we can shut down this distracting line of discussion and then get back to the show? Man, I don't know. How's that for an answer? Andrew?
I think also there's all different ways to look at this based on what you're doing.
Can I say something? Oh. Can I say?
Oh. Took me a second to realize what was happening just then.
Let Justin talk, for crying out loud.
Sorry.
I lost my train of thought.
Oh, sorry. No, you were being heckled.
I'm sorry. Justin meant to say is
I remember. Q&As, because what you guys were doing and what I've done in the past is you know, top down. Here's a show. You're watching the show. And that is, you know, in general, a more passive audience in that there are people that are there. If somebody's jumping up and yelling and screaming, then it's somebody that is passionate. But in general, the people feel about the show however they feel. In a Q&A, there are, I think you almost have more license to use the crowd against the heckler and say, thank you very much, sir. We're going to move on here. There's a lot of people that want questions. There's a lot more of a shared experience there. So if I were in your shoes, that's where I would go, is say, hey, look, I'm the steward of this ecosystem. There's a lot of people that have a lot of questions. And I know as an audience member for Q&As, I have always appreciated a moderator that keeps stuff moving.
Oh, can I share one of the most masterful moves I've seen in that regard is realize that you have the opportunity to inoculate against anything that's going to not go according to plan before the performance even begins. And one of the best versions of that I've ever seen was Andrew, you know, Stevie Starr, the regurgitator.
No.
Well, you don't know about him? Stevie Starr is
I can tell you what he does.
He regurgitates, right? But like he'll take an eight ball, like a literal eight ball from a game of pool, and then suck it down and you know, he appears to barf it back up and so on. One of the best performances I ever saw was him at one of these NACA conferences. So basically, we're in a booth under fluorescent lights. He's sitting down, and his manager stands up, and he sets the rules. He says, listen, a bunch of people are going to tell you that what you're about to see is disgusting. It's not disgusting. It's the best thing you've ever seen in your entire life. This is a remarkable human ability, and it's human, and it's great, and you are going to be better for having seen it. And then, sure enough, that's exactly how everyone expected. Likewise, at Lollapalooza 1992, on the flip side, I saw the Jim Rose Circus Sideshow where he says, hey, listen, what you're about to see is disgusting. It's horrific. It's going to there's going to be a bunch of people who faint. Here's the protocol to deal with people who are fainting. We just need you guys to point and we'll have the paramedics take care of it. That's how powerful of a show this is. They were both doing essentially the same kind of material, but they clearly set expectations and primed the audience going into it for how to react to either one. And so likewise, I would say for the Q&A, where it's like, look, some of you guys are really going to want to get political. That's not what this thing is. You can inoculate a lot of this stuff to begin with.
And certainly, if you want to keep it in a certain cordial thing, to be sure, you can say, "Let's this what's out of bounds and what's in bounds." But I think having a lot of emotion can be good. But I agree that you want to set this up beginning. If you are a weak moderator, and I've seen this in panels now that I've been doing more con panels and stuff, I see weak moderators and strong moderators. A weak moderator, you can't go from a weak moderator to strong moderator, because if you have panelists who are very, very strong or stronger and louder than the moderator, they're going to win. So the best moderators I've seen at the very beginning, they're almost to the point of they don't care about likability. They're like, hey, listen, these are the rules, okay, right, to our panelists, everybody like this. We need short answers, 1 minute answers, your questions from the audience. One question, you get one question. If you go over that, I will take the microphone away from you. You know, we need to get in. And it's, as you point out, you're doing this for the audience. In the fairness to everybody, to get as many questions in as we can, let's keep our questions short and our answers to the point. If you deviate from this, I'll take the microphone away from you now that you know this. And if you set that up from the beginning, okay, when that person deviates and they go along, everybody now knows they cross that line. Right. And you can say, hey, listen, and you can say, cut the mic. You know, you can, you're the sheriff. You're the sheriff there, and you've set what the rules are. Everybody knows the rules, and the rules are for you. And once you're on that position, so it's not you fighting back an unpopular opinion or whatever like that. And it's hard, but you just have to be comfortable being alpha. You have to be comfortable saying, I'm in charge. I'm going to let this go, and then I'm going to stop this. Is it's frustrating because, you know, some people, they're dying to get that microphone to tell everybody else how they think. And I think today there is a sense of entitlement with some people who feel like they need to tell everybody else, you know, about this. And there's not a lot of listening. There's a lot of talking going on.
Well, and it's about passion, right? So you have to do your best to deal with the passionate without inflaming it to the point where it's going to become a distraction. And ultimately, the only answer to that is quick. Just thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your question. And then, you know, use all the tools that you have, because you have the power to shift the audience's attention to the person answering the question.
Yeah.
So if someone's in the middle of asking a question and it's already gone forever, you can just say like, all right, let's just focus on that first one right there. Mr. McGillicuddy, what do you think about that? Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, they're there. You get the mic away from that guy. You set up the next question.
And there's situations where it's one mic and they don't want to give up the mic. And it depends on how far you want to do this. You can literally walk over and stand in front of them. You don't take the mic from them. You don't make physical contact, but you can stand in front of them, blocking their view from the audience. And I've seen this done, and it's an effective technique, because all of a sudden they've now got to go around. You're like, okay, thank you very much. And if you stand in front of them, hold out your hand for the microphone. If they ignore you, you know, they've now transcended in such rude behavior to the audience and all that that they don't realize they've lost them. That's no point.
So if you're looking for a simple heuristic to take away from it, this is how I deal with every customer service representative. I frame my question in such a way that of all the solutions, the easiest one is to give me what I want. So likewise, do the same thing. Frame your Q&A in such a way where everybody's got a different agenda. There's somebody who wants to speak about abortion and inappropriately in the middle of it. If you couch the framework of your performance in such a way, the easiest thing for them to do will happen to be exactly what you want for the performance.
Also, yep. If they're holding the mic and they won't give it up, just give them a little tickle in the ribs, and you know, they'll start giggling, and you just grab the mic right from them.
So, change a topic and perhaps mood a little bit here. On Friday at the Magic Castle, the body of a magician was found. His name's Daryl, and Daryl has been a hero to many people, including Brian and myself, and an amazing magician, amazing magic creator that even if you've never seen Daryl, you've probably seen some of Daryl's creations, because he's been creating magic since he was a very young guy. And it was a pretty heavy loss, and as I've been talking to friends, it's been we're all sort of wrestling with this. And just if you hadn't heard about this, you can look it up. But to be clear, the TMZ report, whatever, was wrong. It was not in a closet. He was not in his underwear. They had this very salacious version of events, which is just not true. I spoke to Daryl a few days before this happened. And then I was at the castle Saturday night just talking to some people there just to kind of hear firsthand, you know, about the circumstances around that. And, you know, one of the things I want to make very clear and talk to one of the first people to see his body, you know, his fully clothed hands were actually in his pocket and probably for whatever reasons to stop himself from trying to prevent this from happening, perhaps. And I don't want to speculate too much about this because only so much stuff has been officially released and, you know, he has a family, et cetera. But anyhow, I bring this up because Brian and I have been talking about this. I've talked about this with other friends, and it's hard when you lose somebody who has always sort of been there and sort of an important part of the magic community.
Yeah, to put it in context, we're currently selling. If you buy a gimmicked deck at scamstuff.com, it's got Daryl's face on it. I mean,
This was before this, yes.
No. But my point being that this is not just some magician. This is somebody who had entered the spiritual pantheon of magic gods who you just, you know, much like you just assume dad's got it under control always. I never occurred to you that it's a human being who's really struggling with difficult stuff. And, any opportunity to talk about this stuff, I think is good. I've spoken a little bit on, Night Attack, about the just bizarre intrusive thoughts of suicide that pop into your mind. It's just, I don't know. It's a really challenging situation. And, he was one of the best. He was one of the best. He came and gave a lecture in Austin, and I enjoyed speaking with him very, very much. And what a tragedy. What a tragedy that he was in such a bad place that even knowing that people would do this unfair, selfish move, chicken out, blah, 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 he paid that price anyway.
It was when I saw his show, I saw a show Tuesday with a few friends, and it was great. You would not have known this was a person going through some sort of, you know, personal anguish. The show was perfect. He was hilarious. The magic was great. It was just spot on. And afterwards, I had the opportunity to talk to him with a couple of their buddies, and we all told him how much we loved the show, how great it was. I was there with Chris Kenner, and Chris Kenner, who's, you know, in his own right, is a magic legend, still a young guy. And Chris had been very influenced by Daryl and told him as much, you know. And that's the thing I was talking to Chris on about the phone with, is like, you know, the weird thing, but it's like the other thing is like we go like, but you know. We had a chance to tell him how we felt, though. We don't have any of that. Well, man, I wish I could have told him.
Yeah, this is the part that really struck home with me, is that you said, you know, oftentimes you go back to your last encounter and you think, what would I have done different? And your answer was not one single thing. Like you were fortunately in that situation where it's like you said exactly what you would say to him if you knew for a fact that he was going to be dead within a few days.
Well, if I knew that, maybe I would have been, you know, a little more.
Maybe yeah, you would have been exactly. Like, hey, I have valuable information that could save your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a challenge. It's one of those things that it's and I don't, again, I, you know, we don't want to speculate or get into that, but it's that sometimes we measure ourselves by the wrong measuring, you know, the measurements. We measure ourselves sort of the wrong way. You know, we look at our bank accounts, we look at, you know, awards, we look at accolades. And then when you talk to people who have those things but don't have a lot of personal contact with other people, you realize what the most important thing that is. And that is just to be able to get on the phone with friends. That is just to be able to hang out with people. And I consider myself such a lucky, lucky person, because I get to hang out with people, I get to be around people I love and I care about. You know, I've created this group of friends around myself here that we've all sort of done this. You know, the three of us are in three different parts of the country, but we make sure once a week at least for the three of us to get together and do this show, because we like hanging out. We're not in a position where we live next door to each other and, you know, we're like, hey guys, let's go grab a beer or whatever like that. But we figured out a way to make that happen. And we figured out, you know, and something that's a part of a club or community that other people can be part of. And if you're not feeling a part of something in your own life, don't wait to be invited. Invite other people, because there are a lot of other people waiting for somebody to say. I just had this conversation last night. I was talking to a friend who, you know, is, you know, lamenting the fact that she doesn't have a lot of people to hang out with. And I said, you know, I had a conversation with somebody else. I called them up. I'm like, hey, why don't we hang out? I'm like, oh, this sounds like a great idea. And it's like, well, it should be obvious, but sometimes it's not.
So,
there's so much where you just wall up inside your own head with your own insecurities. And I've always found this to be, you know, it's something that I always wind up saying, and I never mean it to be disingenuous, but I do think that it is what I find more often, which is that it happens with smart people. The smarter you are, the more that you are able, and I would even say problem solving smart. The better you are at problem solving, I have found, the better you are at creating your own problems. So, and the better you are at creating the reasons why this problem cannot be solved or would require X amount of difficulty, which is why I don't want to do it now. I want to do it later, right? Or you know, I haven't called him in a while, so I don't want to call him now. That'd be weird, right? There's just so much that can just build up in a feedback loop that by the time that it becomes overwhelming, you don't realize that it was really just this one little squeak years ago that caused this loop and 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 the distortion. And that's, you know, it's a problem. And I think it oftentimes keeps us from connecting, like just as people. Exactly what Andrew was just describing of all right, so there's two people and they're lonely on a Friday night and they'd love to hang out with each other. If the other one were to call the other one and say, hey man, I was thinking about you. You want to go see a movie? It would be great. And yet they don't. Why? Because you're afraid, you know, of rejection. You're afraid of having an extension to not feel lonely be a rejection, which now feels even lonelier than you were before.
Yep. Everybody has different needs. You know, somebody points out that they have zero friends they hang out with on a regular basis and feel fine. That's great. I mean, that's good. Everybody, you know, to their own thing. I'm going to say that one of the things I do on a regular basis, I go get a foot massage which sounds weird. I get a foot massage because as primates, we need a little bit of, you know, contact, a little bit of, you know, that. And that makes me a much happier, cheery person. And after I'm hanging out with my friends the next couple of days, I'm a lot happier, cheery.
So I think a more scalable, big version of the same sentiment is the two times I've been the most depressed I've ever been have been shortly after achieving a long-term goal. One was after having the TV show. The other was after becoming firmly established as somebody who was touring in the college market. And the only thing that brought joy was redefining my success and figuring out, like, okay, what is something that I don't have now, but I can feel like I'm getting closer and closer to it. And, you know, nowadays it's very much, you know, about raising my three daughters and so on. Have that thing. You've got to have a purpose. Like, that's the scariest thing, is when your brain crosses into crazy territory of like, well, you already won. You did that thing. The one thing you wanted to do, you did it. So why don't you just eat a bullet? That's danger territory. And
I think part of that is not necessarily the achievement of the goal, but realizing exactly what that looks like. You know, it's like you buy a house and you're like, great, buying a house, the American dream. I've bought a house. And then you realize, oh no, it's just a bunch of cement that I got to fix and pay money constantly on.
Well,
it's
like, who am I? I'm the guy who bought a house that one time. You know, like, it's the identity crisis that was very difficult for me. Like, I guess I'm the guy who eventually got a TV show, and I guess that's over with.
Well, because I think ultimately it just, what you have to realize is that your life is not your achievements.
Yeah.
And that your life will be affected by your achievements, but I don't think you will. You know, like, you are going to be on this journey, and that will involve changing and growing and hopefully nurturing other people. But at the end of the day, because I felt a lot of depression when I first quit my job and I was doing this. And I remember talking, Andrew came down to San Jose for a convention. And I think we were kind of both at a place where we kind of had a lot of what we wanted. And yet it's like, for a million different reasons, it's its own challenge. You know, you got to readjust, and you got to realize, like, okay, well, there's my professional ambitions, and I can always reframe that, and I can look now somewhere else on the horizon. But what I think you should always be hoping for, whether or not this comes along with professional success, is, am I a happier person? Am I doing the things on a daily basis that make me happier? Because here's the big secret. Like, if you are not somebody that can receive happiness, doing all of the things that make you think, well, then I'll be happy, will be wasted on you. You will be somebody at a gorgeous banquet feast with irremovable tape on your mouth. Yes, you're there. Yes, you can smear it. You can smear the turkey and steak on your cheeks, but it will not be... You won't be nourished by it. You won't enjoy it, because you are not able to enjoy the small happiness along the way. So when the big happiness comes, it's just going to be no impact, you know? And that, I think, is ultimately what the daily grind needs to be, is when you are feeling sad, try to be honest with yourself. Why are you feeling sad? Why are you feeling depressed? Why are you feeling, you know, helpless? And it's not an easy task. It's sometimes a scary road to walk down, but it's ultimately worth it if when the good things come, you really, really want to savor them.
Yeah, we don't know nothing. We're just people unpacking this like everybody else. I would say that the times I'm happiest are when I'm too busy to reflect on whether or not I'm happy. And so if you have the ability to set a goal and be working towards, I do know that I'm happiest when I'm working towards a thing, not when I've achieved the thing. As I tweeted recently, being drunk sucks. Getting drunk is awesome. It's the progress towards a goal that is truly wonderful.
I clearly agree. I think that's the, you know, it's John Lennon, life is what happens when you're making other plans, you know, and, you know, the journey is a reward. And I think that if you have a, if, you know, strive for stability, but realize that, like, I mean, for me, it's just, I look at my friends who have a lot, but the thing they value the most is when they can come hang out and be with friends. And, and that's given me a lot of perspective.
There really is, like, there's some magic when you hang around people and you feel like we're heading towards something. You don't know what it is. Nobody knows what it is. But it's like, yeah, are we headed towards an epic evening together? Or I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. Gentlemen, any time now for picks?
Yes. My pick is James Cameron's The Abyss. It's still good. Except for upon watching it 20 years later, there really is a hard left turn in that last act. Like, it really does spend most of the movie being a Cold War troubled drama at the edge of the abyss, and then suddenly just like, oh, and also I'm gonna breathe liquid and go to the bottom of the ocean. Bye. Like, but having said all that, it's still wonderful. It holds up and it's really, really good.
Have you watched the alternate versions of that, Brian?
No. Like, there's one where there's a giant tidal wave and so on, right?
Yep. And technically it's an amazing film. My pick is going to be the book, The Art of Readable Writing by Rudolf Flesch, which I think is just, it's an oldie, but it's good. And it talks a lot about finding your own voice. And that's, I think, a very critical thing, is that we get so focused on, like, oh, what's the proper way to write? And well, there is writing, but there's also voice, and there's finding out what works for you. And he gives a number of examples, and some of them a grammarian would have a fit over, but they're perfectly understandable and actually convey more detail than if somebody was following strict form. So that's my pick, Art of Readable Writing.
You want to know, I'll go ahead and double down on Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. I think that there was a great lesson that I learned from dealing with a copy desk. And there was a lot of the same things that I used to get yelled at constantly that was discussed in that book. So go ahead and take a gander at it. It's definitely worth your time.
But don't do the audiobook version, because the audiobook was pretty much just a half hour NPR program.
Well, yeah. Also, the world's greatest watercolor paintings, like the audiobook. Like, why would you ever
audio? And the audio is just like, I don't know, it's like blue, I guess.
There's like a bunch of I don't know. It looks like you would dip a, like, it was like half paint, half water, and they just like smeared it on. So there's like oranges. It's great. It's like a sunset or something.
I'm glad you said that. I didn't want to be the one have to do that. Brian's love of audiobooks is adorable, but your zeal
first of all, it's not a love of audiobooks. It is an admission of the fact that I just will never take the time to sit down with a book. Like, now that I have a cheat code to read books, you know, 20, 30 books a year, done.
I could understand where you would get the book and you would be like, oh, okay, this is going to be about, you know, the history of the period. And it's like, you know, old Emperor Dotface said that the period will be the only way we end
all
sentences.
All sentences must end with a picture of me represented by a dot.
Like, so I could see where if you thought that was going to be the case, but then you get into it. No, it really is just like a grammar manual and you know, stuff like that. So I would very much encourage people to read it.
Just one more mention is that Steven Pinker has a book that is probably the book, if you want a much bigger, denser book to go into that. And that is A Sense of Style. And this is a linguist telling us, hey, listen, let's take a look at this, because
dude, I just finished The Blank Slate by Steven Pinker. And every time you mention a Steven Pinker book, that's like my next month, because his books are 8,000 pages long. And all brilliant and important.
And he makes some, you know, in this book, he goes into like, hey, here are some things that you've been told that you should never do by Strunk and White. Well, here's where they contradict themselves in their own book. You know, he goes into like, hey, we're told about like, you know, don't use passive voice. Well, here's what science actually says, where passive voice can be much more persuasive. And so it's a kind of an extremely talented writer and scientist says, let's evaluate all these rules that we have and let's look how many of them actually really do make sense. And that's the thing I get into when I talk to editors, like, well, our house style is this. I'm like, well, that house style sucks because that does not convey what I'm trying to do here, you know? And I'm like, and you get into that. I've like people like, oh, we needed this. This person uses this in like dialogue. They say this. I'm like, yeah, they're talking like a normal person, not an English major. And my editors don't
Steven
hear
Pinker
that.
Is a truly remarkable communicator. Like the blank slate made me feel better as a parent. Like it
yeah, made, nothing you can do.
Yes, exactly. It's like what are you doing? What are you doing? Beating yourself up? It's like it's your genetics. You're gonna be fine. Everything's fine.
Yep. So there we go. Another pick. Sense of style. So, gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.